Welcome to this episode of Real Space Strategy. I'm your host, Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Deterrence and Warfighting at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies in Washington, D.C. Real Space Strategy exists to provide you, the listener, a reality check on U.S. space policy and strategy, while giving you insight into the processes required to achieve a credible deterrent and warfighting posture for the United States Space Force. The views expressed by the host and guests in Real Space Strategy are those of the host and guests and are not to be attributed or considered part of any government entity or private sector company. As frequent listeners to this podcast know, I spend quite a bit of time on the threat from China, as that is the main focus of the United States in both great power competition and potential conflict in space, mainly given their robust capabilities and growth in space forces. However, that does not mean that they are the only nation of concern to the United States and its allies. Russia is a spacefaring power that is still very much a force to be reckoned with on the world stage, and that includes the Russian aerospace forces as well. So today, we will focus on the threat to U.S. critical space infrastructure and the homeland posed by the Russian Federation, and to do that, I have asked one of the most well-known and respected experts on this topic of Russian space to join us today. Anatoly Zak is a Russian-born writer, illustrator, and journalist specializing in space exploration, particularly focusing on Russian space programs. He is the publisher of RussianSpaceWeb.com and the author of Russian Space, The Past Explained, The Future Explored. He frequently appears on various TV and radio programs, as well as contributing to numerous publications on space-related topics, and his website has been a great resource of mine over the years, and I highly recommend it to all of you. Anatoly, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Awesome. So let's start with a bit of a scene setter. Russia has been engaged in military space operations for some time, several decades. Could you provide a brief overview of the history of their efforts with military space since Sputnik, and why space forces are of such great prestige and importance to the Russian government?
So, yes, so it's a very long story, and it's kind of hard to do it briefly, but generally, yes, they started in 1957 with the first Sputnik, which was essentially scientific and also a kind of propagandistic spacecraft, which didn't do much besides just doing the sending signals from radio signals from space. But quickly, they did realize importance of space. Even though they were a little bit, it's important to, I think, to mention that they were a little bit slow with understanding the space capabilities of the spacecraft, rather than, because their first Sputnik grew up out of the ballistic missile program, which is a little bit different from space. So it took them a little bit of time, and also another reason they were a little bit slow, that they were a little bit behind on electronics, and they remained so until this day. So it was very difficult for them to integrate and kind of build the spacecraft necessary for effective use and delivering kind of effective tactical and strategic information for the military. But they worked on it since the beginning. Their first spacecraft, which launched first human in space, Yuri Gagarin famously, right, Vostok 1, was essentially an offshoot of a spy satellite program. And that was their emphasis. They wanted to build a spy satellite. And they spent first years of the early years of the program essentially perfecting this system. But very quickly, they also diversified in all other kind of typical military applications of space technology, which is communications, radio surveillance, targeting, and of course, eventually they started building really complex systems for example, for early warning about ballistic missile launches, which was very important part of the strategic assets which Soviet Union developed. They in one aspect of space programs, they went beyond where, for example, United States went. They actually created piloted a space station, and they went through this kind of growing pains of the piloted space program, where they essentially realized that it's not as effective as, for example, robotic spacecraft, and they eventually phased out this program. This program ended, was dead end kind of experiment, but they invested, they went far enough to actually put crews, military crews, into orbit to do surveillance and all other military activities. So in a sense, they were doing this for all these years since 1957 nonstop. They had very difficult years during economic transition when they could not fund the military space as much as they wanted and as much as it was adequate in order to maintain Soviet level of assets. But once, again, once they recovered economically, they immediately started reinvesting into space. In many cases, they had to build the capabilities from scratch from the beginning because they lost them during the 90s. But they also, restored and rebuilt capabilities which they had during the Soviet period. And at this point, they also started building the completely new systems which originated in post-Soviet period. So that's where we find ourselves right now.
Absolutely. I could tell from all of my work with friends and who have worked with the Russian space program is that they're very proud of their space heritage. And up until recently, the reliability of a lot of their spacecraft, even you know, on the manned civil side as well as the military side. But in the past few months, though, the space media and a lot of the aerospace trade press have been reporting on some concerning activities in orbit by some Russian spacecraft, and I thought that would be something interesting to look at. According to Interesting Engineering, an online news magazine, they had this headline. It said, "Russian satellite with suspected weapon maneuvers near U.S. space asset sparks fears." And there was a quote in the article that I thought was interesting. It says, the Russian satellite Cosmos 2588, launched on May 23rd, was placed in a coplanar orbit with USA 338, which obviously means it's a special U.S. spacecraft of some kind. And I was just wondering, from your vantage point as a Russia observer, what can you tell us about this? Are they really demonstrating a co-orbital anti-satellite weapon? And if so, what do you think their motivation is for doing so?
Yes, they do. I mean, so essentially we've seen this activities for a number, we're observing this for a number of years, and they themselves actually said that they're building the platform for observing satellites, so they call it like a satellite inspector. But of course, why would you inspect anything? So essentially it's a most likely anti-satellite program, and it's been basically inactive for the number of years. They were testing this system, and they appear to be perfecting this particular asset. And now, yes, they routinely, we could say that they routinely launch into coplanar orbits where they within the same orbital plane with, for example, some satellites they wanted to chase. For example, it's mostly U.S. satellites, and it's mostly military classified satellites. So it definitely shows that that's where their interest is. But beyond that, they also done a number of experiments where one satellite would release another one, and another one would launch something which was identified as a projectile. So they basically made it quite transparent that they're testing co-orbital anti-satellite system, and they probably have a number of projects in the works of different kinds which would have capability like this.
Are you aware of any operational systems, or are these primarily just test programs, you think?
Well, it's, again, we don't know, but it appears that they are doing the testing at this point. But again, knowing the history, it's very often, at least during the Soviet period, we've seen that the system would be kind of semi-operational. It would be officially still in testing, and it would not be officially in armaments, but it would all already performing the task which would be normally done by operational spacecraft. So it's a matter how you identify it. But I can tell you that they've done enough experiments now. They've done enough of those test flights to essentially be very close to operational use of this system.
Yeah, I think so too. I know they had some history of doing similar things during the Soviet period, at least in the 70s and 80s, if I've read history correctly. And I don't know, as you said, in the 90s, a lot of that expertise went away with the money and other things during the transition. I'm curious about some of that. We may get onto that here in a little bit, but there's another thing besides the coplanar co-orbital ASATs. That a lot of folks have been talking about over the last year since a congressman sort of spilled the beans on it, and that is that Russia has supposedly launched a Pathfinder vehicle of sorts for an orbital nuclear ASAT weapon. And obviously, this is a big deal, something that we really haven't thought about much since the Cold War days. I know there were historically some U.S.-based commissions. To study the Soviet possibility of launching atomic and then hydrogen weapons into orbit as a space bombing kind of capability. And that was one of the fears, obviously, behind Sputnik early on. Is there truth to this being a nuclear weapon in orbit? Have they been as open about that as they have been with the others? And if so, what would that mean for U.S. and allied infrastructure in orbit should they use such a weapon?
Yeah, tough question. I think no. The answer to the last question, that whether they officially admitted this, openly admitted this, I think no. They haven't done anything like that, except that what's interesting is this particular satellite, the first one, which was suspected to have nuclear testing device or some kind of prototype of that nuclear electromagnetic impulse blast type of system. Funny enough, the satellite, they leaked the name of that particular spacecraft, and the name of this is Neutron. So it's almost, you know how there's this whole a culture of analyzing like space patches and different, like looking at what's the Air Force put on a patch and what kind of
Yep.
symbolism. So here's two. You're talking about the neutrons, and they essentially letting people know that that's the name of the spacecraft. Then there is information that it might be actually imaging or radar imaging satellite. So they kind of creating this confusion, but there is almost like a maybe they hinting something to us. So I found this name kind of curious. Besides this, I guess if a congressman or somebody, you know, of that kind of level makes this type of statement, I guess they should have some kind of convincing evidence to say that. So it's hard not to believe, but again, we kind of live in a world where everything is confused, and I'm almost like start thinking, yes, if there are also some indications that this might be an imaging satellite, so maybe they have just a common platform which they testing, and it can be multi-use platform which can carry either the imaging radar or also this anti-satellite vehicle. So that might be a possibility as well.
Yeah, I was curious about some of this because of their military doctrine that as it's evolved over time in the last 20, 30 years to, you know, reserving the right to use a nuclear weapon and of course, you know, if their sovereign territory is attacked, things of that sort. And I was thinking to myself, you know, this could be either an electromagnetic pulse. A lot of people seem to be writing as if it was just sort of a detonation weapon and not that. But if you mention neutron, as the name, you know, back in the 80s, the neutron bomb was sort of an idea where you could be able to, you know, create max damage without hurting the other infrastructure. So that would be intriguing if that had something to do with that angle and not just your standard atomic bomb. So more broadly speaking, I'm curious of. Russia does have quite a bit of stuff they do have. So we talked about a couple of things that they're testing. And according to the Director of National Intelligence Worldwide Threat Assessment for this year, it's quoted as saying, quote, Russia continues to train its military space elements to field new anti-satellite weapons to disrupt and degrade U.S. and allied space capabilities. It is expanding its arsenal of jamming systems. Directed energy weapons, so that could be anything from lasers to high-powered microwaves for those listening in that acronym. On-orbit counter-space capabilities, like the ones we were talking about, and then ASAT missiles designed to target U.S. and allied satellites. And there's a key phrase that was in a little subline beneath that in the document. It says, quote, Russia is using electromagnetic warfare, jamming, to counter Western on-orbit assets and continues to develop ASAT missiles capable of destroying space targets in low Earth orbit. So from everything that I've seen, both in my past military space operational experiences to my policy level positions over the years, it does appear that Russia is not only developing such weapon systems, but are in fact using some of them. What can you tell us about their use of these various weapon systems? Obviously, they were focusing here on electromagnetic warfare and maybe directed energy. Are they just using them in Ukraine, as a lot of people are focused on Ukraine now? Or as the DNI states, have they already been attacking Western on-orbit satellites, so U.S. and our allies?
Okay. So my impression is that they are careful to have this kind of, how they call it, plausible deniability on anything they do, especially on the front line with NATO. They looks like they're trying to avoid, they doing some provocations or maybe some experiments, and they're kind of pushing the envelope and testing the waters, whatever expression you want to use, but they're not going into direct confrontation with NATO at this point. But what I think is important, I think maybe to understand, is that we might have a situation where there is a kind of very gray area between space and non-space. So, for example, there are several examples. So, for example, anti-aircraft systems can be used against spacecraft, at least low-orbiting spacecraft sometimes. Anti-missile systems can have anti-satellite role. And also with all this electronic warfare systems, right? So we have all this Krasukha, all these famous things which were, and by the way, some of them were captured in Ukraine. They have space capability apparently as well. At least that's what I saw in the press. So when they use this, and especially with radio waves, right? It's where do they end? What, like where, how far does it go? So when they're using them, they might, you know, have interference in low orbit or, you know, these are systems which are hard to define, even put them into them categories and stuff like that. But they definitely, I think, they expanded into space, the capability of those electronic warfare, anti-satellite, anti-missile, and anti-aircraft defense systems. They're all becoming kind of less and less easy to define them.
Yeah, I think if I remember right, also on the cyber side is also used for ground segment attacks, not just your standard lasers and missiles. I think right. Early on, before they brought in their invasion in 21 or so, that I think they, I'm trying to remember here what that was called. Oh, Viasat. I think there was a lot of Viasat terminals were attacked by sort of a counter-space cyber-related thing, and it not only impacted Ukraine, but it impacted several Western European countries as well from a communication standpoint, not to mention a lot of jamming of GPS signals in and around Europe with commercial airliners and shipping and stuff. And pretty much everybody in those trade presses are all pointing back at the Russians, that it's not all just within the war-fighting region of Ukraine proper in the Crimean Peninsula, but it's also a little bit wider. And I always thought that was interesting that, you know, NATO is a little slow at getting up to speed on the space situation. They're kind of using rhetoric that really described reality about 20 years ago, and they're still trying to figure themselves out on how they should respond to these sorts of things. But and I know that since everybody is pretty focused on the Russia-Ukraine war, even some of the think tank folks like myself are writing lots of articles about the space usages within that conflict. Do you think their space forces have helped Russian military strategy in that war, given the fact that it's kind of been kind of slow moving, a lot slower than a lot of people thought it would be, and or has it not really been all that useful at all? And I guess just one example to kind of show you where I'm coming from, I remember hearing stories of Russian pilots who have crashed and people are going through the wreckage and they find commercial Western GPS aid navigational devices in their fighter aircraft because GLONASS, the Russian position navigation and timing system, isn't working all that well. So I'm just curious if you had a thought on what is the impact of Russian space systems and their counter space forces in achieving Russian and political military objectives in Ukraine.
Yes. I also remember those stories. We also, besides this, another like kind of great example of this is that they're trying to get Starlink dishes on the black market and using them. And quite actively, I hear a lot of the kind of telegrams messages and a lot of we've seen a number of photographs where they trying to kind of smuggle those antennas into the battlefield. So all of this, of course, illustrates that kind of great inadequate preparation of the space segment for this type of conflict on the Russian side. And but having said that, it's very similar where very often they show photographs of Russian forces using donkeys in Ukraine and say, well, look how bad they are. But yes, they're doing all of this. But at the same time, look, they have this huge army. They have this huge, essentially, forces and many tanks and everything. And so it's a kind of glass half full. Depends how you want to see it. So they definitely have space assets. I've seen photographs of them using Russian satellite communications. But all of this is, first of all, there are two-fold issue which they have. First of all, they don't have enough, right? So they don't have enough. For example, they have a satellite for communications in a geostationary orbit. They don't have enough ground terminals for all the units of the Russian army to use that. So the big bosses, like, you know, the generals in the headquarters, they will have this fancy system. But in the field, they will not have enough, or they have very few. For example, with GPS and GLONASS, right, the Russian equivalent, they probably have GLONASS integrated somewhere, but it doesn't work as well as GPS. First of all, it's behind, for in its capabilities, it's still years behind of the American system, at least military version of it. And also, they don't have enough terminals, they don't have enough infrastructure, essentially, on the ground to implement all of this. And of course, I think another kind of area where this is kind of plays out is reconnaissance, right? They have spy satellites, simply speaking, satellites which do visual reconnaissance. They started launching recently radar satellites. But those satellites is kind of far in between. They just don't have enough of them. They do not overfly the same area often enough for them to provide kind of updated imagery. So everything, all their assets, I think, have this same characteristic, that they exist, they're working on them, they're perfecting them, but it's not enough, and it's not developed enough to match capabilities which West has, and the West partially provided to Ukraine. And also, it's not efficient enough. So essentially, those systems, even if they do have them in the field, they're not as good as the Western systems. For example, Starlink is a good example of that. And in fact, with Starlink, they now investing into the similar system, and they trying, at least, you know, being years later, but they trying to deploy, they plan to deploy a similar system, which is at least maybe not as good as Starlink. And it will, of course, will not be as numerous as Starlink. For the low orbital satellite system, which is important to understand, you need thousands of satellites. They will not have this. We know they will not be able to launch as many. But they will launch them in a higher orbit, in a smaller numbers, so they will have something similar. So to kind of summarize, they're behind, but they're trying hard, and they're running very hard, and they're trying to catch up.
Understand. You know, one of the things I'm interested in is in the Western press, you hear a lot about, ground battles and even some of the pilots that are engaging with the Ukrainians and vice versa. You don't really hear a whole lot about the Russian aerospace forces, which of course is the combination of their formerly known as space forces and a few other odds and ends. I don't know if you're following Russian press at all, but are they ever mentioning that service as much as they do the ground and air forces of Russia engaging in that conflict, or is it strictly more of a hush-hush kind of a service for the Russians?
No, I think it's that VKS abbreviation of Военно-космические силы. This is Air and Space Forces. That sounds no. You hear about them, especially when they merged. Kind of this military aircraft forces and the Air Force and the space segment. So you hear it much more than, let's say, a few years before. And yeah, it's. They hear about it. They do mention it. So I would say no. Its profile became higher in the past few years.
Okay. So I know you'd mentioned this kind of a little bit earlier when it comes to how they're trying hard and they have different sort of different viewpoints. One of my interest areas is how, obviously, as a strategy-minded kind of person, is how an adversary thinks. Because a lot of the reason why they posture a certain way and fight a certain way is all based on either what some authors have called national style, others call strategic culture. And there was a book that came out from an author named Oscar Janssen. You might be familiar with him. He wrote a book a few years ago called The Russian Understanding of War, Blurring the Lines Between War and Peace. And you had mentioned that gray area, as we typically say in the West, Western world. And I'm just going to read a little paragraph, and I had a follow-up question for you here. So bear with me here. It says, this is toward the end of the book, and it says, in the conflict with Russia, there is a fundamental assumption that is fallacious. Western states believe it is up to them to choose whether they enter a war with Russia or not. This underpins every action that simultaneously seeks to punish Russian hostility while, quote, avoiding escalation. The problem is that this view assumes that the current situation is one of peace. Rather, as the Russian leadership sees itself in an information war, being targeted with color revolution subversion is equivalent to a use of force. The borderline between war and peace has been blurred, with the current confrontation already in the blurred area. It is only necessary for one party to see itself in the blurred area of war for war to exist. This mirrors the Russian understanding of war, which has always been closer to the view of the permanent struggle and insatiable insecurity, whereas the Western understanding has been more binary, with a war slash peace divide. So I was thinking about that as I was going through my notes for our chat today. So I was wondering if you thought that Russia believes it's in a war already with the United States and NATO, at least in cyberspace and outer space. Since you mentioned the gray zone.
Yes, it's a little bit philosophical question and in a kind of very subjective, only subjective way to answer it. And what I almost think now is that when we say Russia, what are we talking about? It's almost like, Russia doesn't really have an agency at this point. What we've seen in the past, let's say 15, 20 years, is the consolidation of power in a kind of hands of a single person, and that's Putin, of course. And so we should not even be concerned what Russia thinks. What we need, I think, right now at this point, discuss is what Putin thinks. And what we see again in the past 15, 20 years, he kind of evolved or kind of drifted from this kind of mafia state boss to really this ideological, Cold War warrior, right? Or almost like imperialist who wants to rebuild the fallen empire. It's almost like a revisionist type of effort where he wants to kind of take revenge for the loss of the Cold War. very similar, like you saw, like in Germany between the wars in the 30s, right, where they wanted to kind of correct the wrongs of the World War One with World War Two, and we see now that he's essentially built this kind of semi-fascist, semi-religious, semi-fascist system where he looks for expansion to take revenge for the loss in the Cold War and also to restore the empire and essentially project the, its influence way beyond current Russian borders. So I would answer this. So I have this very dim view. I you know, I'm very pessimistic about what he's doing. And also, I think it's important to mention again, and it involves space directly, he's rebuilding the Russian industry and Russian economy and the entire Russian state for not just for the war with Ukraine, but the, for the war which will last many years and many even decades. So yes, they absolutely, the people who support him, and of course, he was able to brainwash into this position a lot of people. We don't, again, we cannot even begin to understand how many of these people believe this kind of ideology. Because again, all experts in public opinion, they say that you cannot get reliable numbers from Russia. But let's assume that, you know, like any society, it's divided 50-50. Even if you divide the 50-50, 100 million people, you get 50 million people who believe this. So so that is essentially a very sovereign kind of understanding, yes, that he is in a war already with everybody else. He's just physically fighting in Ukraine, and he wants to avoid, he understands that he's still in the militarily, he's behind the West, and he will be defeated if he goes against NATO, let's say. But he's doing this hybrid war. So he's doing the ideology, he's doing the political, he's kind of he's doing his propaganda all over the world, and on that in that aspect he's succeeding.
Yeah, interesting. I know you mentioned the industry, and real quick, I remember, I think it was 2015, was sort of like the last gasp of a private industry in the Russian space industry, and that's when they started doing the nationalization and basically making a nice hierarchy that would report eventually to Putin. I think he was in that prime minister holding tank position while they fixed the constitution in the Duma, while Medvedev was sort of his puppet. At least that's how a lot of people saw it. Are you thinking that command economy style space industry is sufficient to compete against the United States and if they ever break with the Chinese alliance, so-called, that they will be able to compete with them too? Or is that a Russian system that typically doesn't work very well?
Yes, so my understanding is that yes, they do understand that this system is inadequate. The state-owned system is not working, and they do know that they're behind, and they do know that they need reforms, and they do need a private sector to work for them. And in fact, they made some significant steps. So this Russian Starlink equivalent is a very good example where they essentially now funding, supporting private company and a startup company, which essentially started from zero, and now it looks like this company will actually be the prime contractor for the system, disregarding completely this huge industry, the big companies which were involved in this type of work since like beginning of the space era, since the 60s, right? And they instead they go to this startup business, which is work very kind of American way. It looks American. It looks, everything is like they copy, and even like small details, even their furniture and their offices look like SpaceX, right? So this company is doing this, this building, this developing this Starlink equivalent, and of course, you know, we know that it's of course, you know, it has huge military significance. So that's here you go. That's an example where they are trying to essentially reformed their industry. There are similar examples, smaller ones, for example, in imaging satellites. There are some startups which they are trying to develop. So they were not very successful initially, but looks like now it's with all this huge money which are being redirected into this semi-dual purpose, dual-use technologies, looks like they started, they have some movement in this area.
Interesting. So speaking of the geopolitical, which I know you were very interested in that one, in that question, but here's another one for you. There have been numerous articles, obviously, about Russia partnering and allying with China in space. They share a combined SOSI space tracking network, supposedly, and they are partnering with the Chinese on a lunar base project and even looking at providing a nuclear reactor to power it for the Chinese. And given the kind of respect that Putin and his team really desire, and pretty much that a lot of Russian governments have expected since Peter the Great helped them become a great power, what do you think it would take Russia, why do you think Russia would want to take on a perceived junior partner role with China because of their, you know, former leadership? And what do you think the reason is for this alignment in military and civil space activities?
Mm-hmm. So this is this question which I kind of studied for a number of years, and my understanding is that they probably now see, especially in the past few years, the human spaceflight and piloted spaceflight, as they call it, is a kind of financial burden for them, because they, of course, not earning any money with this, and it doesn't have direct military application. So human spaceflight is purely status type of activity for them. This is something which they were doing since the beginning of the 60s, and it's almost like a religious experience for them to have people in space. And they were very lucky for the past 30 years, because NASA essentially was providing them that platform where they had very prominent position. They were equal partners in this arrangement of the International Space Station. And they were essentially doing it at NASA's expense. NASA was paying for the project. They were doing some contribution, of course. They had significant budget. And now they find itself in a situation where this program might be coming to an end. And they have to understand that they do understand, actually, that they either have to reinvest very heavily into human piloted space flight in order to have their own space base, or they have to find another partner who would kind of with whom they can piggyback. And they had for a while that dream that they might be China will be providing that kind of cooperative platform for them in the form of that space station. And of course, and I know for sure they were heavily negotiating that, and they were trying to convince Chinese to do this. But in the end, as we've seen, they launched the space station into the orbit, which is very difficult for Russian spacecraft to reach. And essentially, they essentially told Russians that no, we're not going to play that game, and you're not going to get a deal from us, with the kind of deal you got from NASA for the past 30 years. So they facing that dilemma right now. They have to go alone. They have to do it themselves, and it's quite expensive. And in fact, it's also not only expensive. It's from the engineering standpoint, it's quite difficult to do, because now they have to build their own space station from scratch and operate it if they want at least the minimal destination for their cosmonauts in orbit. So we will see how it's going to develop, but so far it's difficult for them.
Yeah, there's a lot of history between those two countries going back to Cold War communist days between Mao and Stalin, and that was part of the thing that Nixon used, obviously, you know, historically to try to counterbalance against the Soviet Union, and I just thought that was interesting because of that history. It's, you know, from everything I've learned of studying Russian history and culture, is that they have very long memories, and so this must be really important to them in my mind if they're willing to put up with that kind of a a response from the Chinese. Real last, our last question kind of gives you sort of the opportunity just to share with whatever you'd like briefly, and that is what other space weapon systems or capabilities should planners in the Space Force or the U.S. government be concerned with about from Russia, and what do you think Space Force should do about any of these items that we've discussed today?
Okay, well, I'm not exactly a space strategist, but I would say that, it's I still believe that United States are far ahead of Russia in space in all aspects of at least military applications of space. They're far ahead. They have very good intelligence. They have very good informational system for command and control and all these aspects of. But going forward, again, it's we see that the modern war is not necessarily not always just technical capabilities. It's also political will. It's also the kind of the strengths of your argument. It's also your kind of, again, understanding who are you really at war or not? Because again, we're facing the hybrid war, and also this kind of almost grain of kind of borders between different technologies and different systems and between satellite networks and computer networks on the ground, and this blurring of the margins and kind of the kind of mixture and confusion in the systems. It's almost I almost feel like we can even see the satellites where they launched as a, for example, observation or remote sensing satellites, but they also carry some anti-satellite capabilities with them because the systems become smaller and they become more efficient. We have electric engines which are very fuel efficient and very small. So it's almost you have to sometimes it's almost like another Sputnik moment. You have to kind of be in the right place in the right time to realize that the danger is really coming from this kind of direction. And almost to be ready for this non-traditional, not something which you've seen in the past kind of systems to emerge or face you. So I would put it this way. But again, very difficult question.
Yeah, I try to keep it easy for my guests. So with that, I want to say thanks again, Anatoly, for being with us today. And thank you for listening. And this is Christopher Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, Chris, thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
Thank you. You've been listening to Real Space Strategy. Real Space Strategy with Christopher Stone is a production of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. And for more information, see us at our website, thinkdeterrence.com. That's thinkdeterrence.com. Our YouTube page, and any of our various social media sites on whichever platform you choose.
The Miz Podcasting Network.